As an introduction to my thoughts this morning, I want to read a couple of passages out of Isaiah. First one is from Isaiah 42, just a few verses here. Sort of in keeping with our Sunday school thoughts, actually the theme of my message follows a theme we've been looking at in our Sunday school. But in Isaiah 42 and verse 13, the prophet writes, "The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall cry, yea, roar. He shall prevail against his enemies. I have long time holden my peace. I have been still and refrained myself. Now will I cry like a travailing woman. I will destroy and devour at once. I will make waste mountains and hills and dry up all their herbs," or vegetation in more current English. "And I will make the rivers islands," that is, the rocks will appear as the banks stand out and the water shrinks, "and I will dry up the pools. And I will bring the blind by a way that they knew not. I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them and not forsake them." And then jumping back to Isaiah chapter 30, just a couple of verses there. Isaiah chapter 30 and verse 20. Isaiah writes, "And though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not thy teachers be removed into a corner anymore, but thine eyes shall see thy teachers, and thine ears shall hear a word behind thee, saying, This is the way, walk ye in it, when you turn to the right hand and when you turn to the left." And it always interests me when we sit in a worship service and I have in mind what I'm planning to share, and I hear those thoughts coming out in the devotions and in the Sunday school discussion as we think about how God leads us through adversity, and he leads us in ways that are beyond our ability to come up with or understand so many times. We had the privilege of sharing supper with a couple of teachers who came down to Pensacola for a PCC teachers workshop a few weeks ago. And as I was sitting there mostly listening to some of the accounts of the teachers and the things that they had faced and what got them into their teaching calling, I was fascinated by some of the things that were shared. And one of the teachers shared how she had actually been involved in teaching. She had taught for a few years and she felt like she was just beginning to get good at it. And then the call came for her to go into nursing, and she thought, why would I want to do that? I'm already serving the Lord, and I'm serving the Lord in a way that's effective, and I'm just starting to get good at it. Surely God wouldn't want me to quit teaching in order to go into nursing. That doesn't make any sense at all. But every objection that she raised got answered, one after the next after the next. And finally, she was holding on to just one thing. And she was saying, well, it wouldn't be right for me, since I don't have the money to afford the education I need for nursing, if I would go into debt in order to get the education I need to fill this role that I'm called to fill. So there it is. It's done. It's off the table. And then a few days later, one of the brothers in the local congregation came up to her and he said, you know, I've been meaning to talk to you. I heard somewhere at some point in time that you were interested in nursing. And I have this money I've been hoping to do something for the Lord with, and I wasn't sure exactly what to do. And as I was praying the other day, I just felt like I should come to you and ask, do you need funding for something? I think maybe it would be helpful if we would pay for your nursing education. And she was like, okay. So she went into nursing, and she felt like God led her that way. And she felt like she was able to serve in that way, and she touched a number of lives in that way. She felt like she was getting good at nursing. She felt like she was in a role where she was very needed, in a facility where her influence was very needed, and that she was doing good work for God. And guess what? The desperate school board started reaching out to her and saying, you got to come back and teach. we absolutely need a teacher. And she said, I've been there, I've taught, and God has called me into nursing. And so here I am nursing, and I'm happy where I am, and I'm starting to get good at it. And I have things going here that are effective, so I'm going to just keep nursing. Well, I can't go into every detail, but I think we know the end of the story. She ended up back in the classroom, and she is finding it very fulfilling and very meaningful as she teaches there. Life can lead us some interesting ways, but those thoughts and accounts dovetailed with what we've been studying in Sunday school and what my wife and I have been reading in the book of Deuteronomy as Moses recounts the history of the children of Israel. And so my thoughts this morning are taken from Exodus 14 that we looked at last week. And the title of my message this morning is Red Sea Responses. So we'll be looking at this text as a guide to our thoughts and as we consider God's leading in our lives and the ways that we can respond to the adversity and the trials that we face, the challenges that we face. And I don't know what you're facing here. I just know that you're people, and so are we. And every one of us faces challenges, trials, crossroads of decision, and we have to know how are we going to respond. How are we going to respond? Now, as we look at Exodus 14, I think we're all aware God's work with the children of Israel is what's in focus. The children of Israel are facing the Red Sea in this chapter, and we all know the history. We just went over it. They were suffering in cruel bondage in Egypt. They witnessed God's work in the mighty plagues on Pharaoh and on the nation of Egypt, some of which they were specifically spared from in miraculous ways. They started listening to Moses and following his commands. And finally, when Moses told them that they need to kill a lamb and that they need to smear that blood on the doorposts and on the lintel of the door, they obeyed and they did what he told them to do. And as they waited in their houses that night with the blood on the door and wondered what God was going to do and what was going to happen, they heard the cries of the Egyptians over the death of their children because they were devastated with the hand of God over them with the judgment that he had promised that he would pour out. And so they fled their homes that night with whatever possessions they could carry, and they went out of the land of Egypt, forced to do so by the Pharaoh who said he would never let them go. And God did what they had hoped for and what they had wished for in a way that they were not able to have dreamed up or imagined. And then they ended up leaving the bondage of Egypt. They ended up being compelled to go out, and their neighbors actually gave them things as they went out, and they left Egypt. But now they've arrived here on the banks of the Red Sea. And as the Israelites are huddling here on the edge of the Red Sea, that's probably days later, but I'm sure in some sense they were probably still sleep deprived. Perhaps they were still a bit euphoric with their escape from Egypt. No bondage, no slavery. We're out. I don't know how this happened. Praise the Lord. Maybe they were a bit confused. Maybe they were unsure of what the future held or exactly where things were going to go next. Maybe they were trying to find a new routine, living out of things, the luggage that they carried. But at that point, whatever it was, the news swept through the camp that Pharaoh and his army were coming down on them. And you know that situation. You understand that event as you look here at this chapter. But can we place ourselves in their shoes? Because you can well imagine, I think, if you consider for a moment, the terror, the doubt, the confusion that swept over them as everything they had hoped for seemed to come crashing down, and they look back and they realize that the entire Egyptian army, the greatest force in the whole world, was coming down specifically to capture or destroy them. We'll begin reading here in Exodus 14 and verse 10. And when Pharaoh drew nigh, the children of Israel lifted up their eyes, and behold, the Egyptians marched after them, and they were sore afraid. And the children of Israel cried out unto the Lord. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt thus with us to carry us forth out of Egypt? Is not this the word that we did tell thee in Egypt, saying, let us alone, that we may serve the Egyptians? For it had been better for us to serve the Egyptians than that we should die in the wilderness. And I'm not sure which is worse in the state of human emotions, whether you think there is no hope and nothing is going to happen that you want to happen, or whether you think you have all the hope and then all of a sudden all of that hope is dashed. But these Israelites were facing a very difficult situation. And I don't know that we've ever faced anything quite this difficult, but I think we can relate in some sense. They were beginning to understand the power of God. They had finally decided they were going to step out in faithful obedience and leave their homes, leave everything that they were familiar with, leave everything that they grew up with, leave their family history going back generation after generation after generation. And they decided that because of who God had revealed himself to be, they were going to follow this God out into the wilderness wherever he led them to another land that they'd never been to in paths that they weren't familiar with. And suddenly, the God that they thought they could trust seemed as if he had turned them over to their worst nightmare. And as you watch that, as they watched that military coming down on them, how did they respond? They responded like this. Is there a parallel in our lives? And one universal parallel I thought of is early in our Christian experience, we take similar steps of faith as we begin to ask ourselves the question, can God really deliver on his promises? Can God do what people say he can do? Is it possible that I can find relief from guilt? Is it possible that I can find forgiveness for my sins? Is it possible that I can find a new life and a new way of living? And at some point, if we're Christians today, we have accepted that invitation of God and we have said, yes, I believe that God is able. I believe that I can come to him. I believe that he will accept me, that he will forgive my sins, that he will welcome me into his presence, that I can have relationship with him. And perhaps for a short time, you were carried forward on sort of the euphoria of saying, yes, God did what he said he would do. Isn't it wonderful to be a Christian? And sometimes you look at a new Christian and it takes you back and you think, oh, what happened? To be so carefree, to be so happy, to be so trusting of God. But all too soon, at some place, at some point in our Christian journey, and it usually doesn't take long, we are faced with hardship or trial or difficulty or defeat or temptation. And then what? And as we look at their responses to crisis, as we consider this crisis moment, the first response we see from the Israelites was unfortunately a negative response. And that was, I think, a very natural response, but the response of fear. And I don't know that we would have responded any differently. I've never had anybody come at me with a gun or an army. I had someone pull a knife on me one time, but I think our natural response is fear. As humans, we tend to judge situations and challenges based on our ability to control them, and we respond accordingly. If I see a butterfly flitting through the air and coming close to me, my heart rate doesn't go up. I don't scream or run. I'm fine with that. Even if it alights on my shoulder, I don't really care. Maybe I'm actually overwhelmed with some little sense of wonder. Wow. A butterfly. But a hornet is a different story, right? I remember as probably a 10-year-old, living in Kentucky there, it was hard to have a yard that wasn't on a slope, and the yard kind of had a slope down to the creek. We were playing a little bit of soccer there in the yard, and somebody kicked the ball too far. And I went racing after it as fast as I got. I was going to stop that ball before it hit the creek. And I either didn't know or I had forgotten that there was a branch that hung down over the creek with a giant hornet's nest in it. But about the time my head contacted the hornet's nest, I realized what was going on. And when I heard that buzz, I was already headed out as fast as I could go. But there was a lot of motivation to move because I wasn't interested in being attacked by hornets. And yet I could almost imagine a case in which that hornet's nest with its hornets could be somehow in an enclosed, safe box, and I would come look at it and say, well, that's interesting. As humans, we look at situations, we look at circumstances and adversities, and we react to how we perceive them to be. And since our fears are based on our perceptions instead of the facts, they don't always reflect the actual danger. Statistics say, for instance, that more people are scared of flying than are scared of driving, but more people die in cars than in airplanes. You can go down through a whole list of statistics like that. Maybe personally we have experienced some of those things. Maybe you have a piece of machinery that could be dangerous. Maybe it's just a circular saw or a nail gun or something. And at first you're like, oh, it's got a blade or it shoots nails. I guess I need to be a little cautious. But as time goes on and you use it every day, who cares? You have no thought anymore. And I remember one of the contractors I used to work for, he said, you need to be careful and not forget. He was very safety conscious, which was probably good. He said, I knew a man who worked as a roofer, and he would, nowadays we mostly put plywood or OSB or something on the roof, but back in that day it was 1x12s they put on the roof. They would nail them down and they'd cut off the ends, or they'd measure it to length and cut off the ends, and he'd be sitting up on there on the roof and he'd grab that board and he would cut off the end, and he would always have his saw just come back down and rest on his leg. Just cut it, the guard would flip up, he'd rest it on his leg. Just cut the next one. It was fine. It went on for years. One day the guard stuck. And so our perception of things isn't always accurate. Sometimes it's very inaccurate. And because of this, it is easy for us to misjudge situations, particularly leaving God out of the picture. And when we face something like the Israelites faced, we can be very tempted to stay inside the boundaries of what feels safe to us, a place where we feel we're going to be safe, and to not give God the credit that he's due in his ability. And you can say to yourself, those Israelites, they sat there and they watched God pour out 10 plagues on the nation of Egypt. Surely they knew, sitting there at the edge of the Red Sea, God could do it again. But you're a human and you know, they had to ask themselves, will God do it again? And so they said, we're better off in Egypt. We'd be safer there than here because we're about to get annihilated by the way it looks to me. There's a story that's been passed down through the family, I guess, about a couple who were called to go to the mission field. And the wife in particular was concerned about the dangers they might face there in a foreign country that wasn't very well developed, and all sorts of possibilities. Her young children there, and just didn't feel like it would be safe, it would be a good idea, and they wrestled with it for a while, and finally, I guess partially because of her expressed fears, they decided they're not going. They're staying right here where they are, and they're not going to the mission field. And not long after, her children were playing there, close under the trailer, ran into a little nest of rattlesnakes, got bitten and died. So where was the safe place? And sometimes, or too often, we misperceive. And so I read in those verses in Isaiah in the opening, where God says, I will lead them in paths that they have not known. I will make darkness light before them and crooked things straight. These things will I do unto them and not forsake them. It's a promise of God that we step out in God's ways, in what God is asking us to do, that we can trust God, that he will work it out for his glory and for our good. Not the way we want it to work out, not the way we imagine it would work best, but the way God knows is best. So while it's expected that we may feel fear, fear is not the response God wants from us as we face difficult situations. The second response we want to look at, another negative response, is the response of unbelief. And we see that here in the Israelites. As I mentioned, they had the history of seeing God work, and all of us in some way do as well, if we've been a Christian at any length of time, or familiar with the scriptures at all. We know God has worked in the past. He's working in the present. We have that that we could remember, but too often we forget. And as the Israelites viewed the situation, they thought to themselves that if they couldn't handle the situation, then God had let them down, and God was not trustworthy because he had not kept things in a realm that the Israelites themselves could control. And I have talked to many Christians who eventually had to admit, in all honesty, that they simply didn't trust God because they weren't sure what to do with the fact that people get sick, that people die, that children can be killed in accidents, or that wars happen, and they just struggled to believe that God is trustworthy. But it's a wrong perspective. It's a misunderstanding. It's an inaccurate view of God and his work in the world. And so as we focus on trying to prevent pain, and as we focus on trying to control circumstances, our trust of God can be lost. And we can, of course, point fingers at the Israelites. It's quite obvious in hindsight what they should have done, but we ourselves face very similar challenges in trust. And I remember reading this story about the Ken Davis, when he gave his early public speaking class. It has stuck in my mind. I guess it's just because it's one of those stories that seems to illustrate the point quite well. But the teacher said they would be graded on their ability to drive home their point in a memorable way. And so he thought about it for quite some time, and he finally thought, okay, I think I have a way that would drive home my point in a memorable way. And so the title of his talk was The Law of the Pendulum. And he spent 20 minutes teaching what the law of the pendulum was and giving examples. And he went up to the blackboard and he drew diagrams. And he even took a top and hung it off of a string in the middle of the blackboard. And he held it off to one side and they let it go and they watched it swing back and forth and he marked it every time. And he just confirmed in everyone's mind that the law of the pendulum is absolutely true, which is that once the pendulum is released, it never reaches as high a point as the one it was released from. It always is a diminishing arc until it finally stops swinging. And so after he was done presenting this whole 20-minute talk, he turned to the audience of students and the teacher who was sitting in the back and said, "How many of you believe in the law of the pendulum?" And they all nodded their heads. "Sure, I understand. It's clear enough. I've seen it demonstrated. I believe. That's fine." But they also had to wonder what he was going to do with the thing that was hanging from the ceiling. They weren't quite sure. And of course, they had suspended from the steel ceiling beams on the 500-pound test parachute cord, 250 pounds of metal. He said, "Okay, one more thing. The instructor, could you please come up?" I guess he was concerned about his grade. So he set a table up against the block wall, and he put a chair on it, and he had the instructor sit up in the chair, his head up against the wall. And he said, he re-explained the law of the pendulum, and he said, "Do you believe in the law of the pendulum?" And the instructor paused and wrestled with it, and he said he saw sweat coming out on his forehead, and he said, "Yes, yes, I do." And so he pulled that up to his nose, and he let it go. And you could just hear the whoosh as it goes out across. And as it's coming back, it got about halfway back and started coming toward the table. He said he didn't think he'd ever seen anyone move so fast in his life. Dived under the table, and then he turned to the class and said, "Does he believe?" They were, "Guess not." But it graphically illustrates the kind of thing that we face, because we can have Christianity in a mental space that we think is perfectly comfortable. And we say, "Yes, I believe in God. He's faithful. He does what he says he will. Let me quote you a Bible verse." But we all know when it comes down to living life, that's where the challenge happens. And we see this. Let's continue reading here in Exodus 14, verse 13. "And Moses said unto the people, Fear ye not, stand still, and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will show to you today. For the Egyptians you have seen this day, you shall see them again no more forever. The Lord shall fight for you, and you shall hold your peace." Okay, now we have both sides of the equation. We have the Israelites who responded negatively and said, "Leave, take us back to Egypt." And we have Moses saying, "You don't need to fear. You don't need to fear, because the facts are God is on your side. He's going to deliver you, and the Egyptians will be destroyed." But what did they actually believe? That's the question. What did they actually believe? And at this point in the story, if you were to stop here and you didn't know the rest of the story, you could guess perhaps what Moses would do, or maybe you could guess what the Israelites would do. But the fact of the matter is, at this point, their responses are not complete. Now, Moses had been through a lot of trying experiences with God. He had certainly made his mistakes. He had tried to create an escape plan for the nation of Israel on his own, and it had failed miserably, and he had ended up having to run for his life. He had met God in the wilderness. He had argued with God there about God's plan and whether it was feasible or could possibly work. He had been before Pharaoh time and again, only to see the things that he had spoken on God's behalf rejected and turned down. Moses had a history. Here he was urging the people to a positive response. But what did they believe? What would they do? What did Moses believe? Fortunately, as the story continues, we begin to see some positive responses as Moses leads here. So the third response we want to look at, but the first positive response, is focus on God. Moses realized here that it was not helpful to focus the attention on the capabilities of the Israelites. They didn't really have any. And it certainly wasn't helpful to focus the attention on the military prowess of the Egyptians. They appeared to be superior. But it was important that the focus be turned to God. We are not the ones who are capable of controlling the universe. God is. We are not the ones who have to resolve difficult situations in their entirety. God can. So the focus should not be on us. The focus should be on God. And that's what Moses is already introducing to them here. As he says, "Fear ye not, stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." Now it's interesting, he didn't say, "There's no need to be afraid. Why are you worried about getting caught up in your feelings here? Everybody just take a deep breath. It's going to be great." That's not what he said. He said, "Stand still and see the salvation of the Lord." And there could be some value in laying down your anxieties for a moment, but there is no meaningful change without placing your focus on the divine creator of the universe. When we read that in Isaiah 42, "The Lord shall go forth as a mighty man. He shall stir up jealousy like a man of war. He shall prevail against his enemies." And we need to remember that. We don't only need to remember that factually, we need to remember that spiritually and emotionally and internally. God is all-powerful. God is in control. God has taken care of difficult situations in the past. God is able to take care of situations in the present. God has already assured us of what the future is. We can trust Him. And as we meditate on the work of God and the faithfulness of God and the experiences of those who have trusted God, it helps us to remember that God is able, that He will not lead us where He cannot sustain us. So successfully facing these experiences requires us to place our focus on God. But that is not all. That's the starting point. That's the first positive thing we can do when faced with challenge and difficulty and overwhelming anxiety or fear or worry or things that feel beyond our control. But we need to move beyond that. And so the second positive response I have here is the response of change. And I stated it this way, as I will try to explain, because I think this is a step that takes place shortly after or as we begin focusing on God. God leads us. Maybe this is a difficult one for us to grasp, but God leads us into crisis situations because He knows that we need to focus on Him, and He's interested in changing us from dysfunctional people into the image of His Son, Jesus Christ. And if our focus is truly on God, and if we truly are aware of who He is and what His work is and what He's trying to do, change is inevitable. We have to change our thinking. We have to correct our beliefs. We have to surrender our desires. We have to grow in our faith in God. One of my small groups, we are studying a book entitled Experiencing God, and one of the things that the book teaches is this: we are only one change away from a great work of God. As long as we limit what we let God do with us, only serving in our strengths, only reaching people we feel comfortable with, only serving in an area where we feel safe, only serving as long as our reputation is intact, then our experiences will be dry and narrow. God will not use us. God will use us as much as our character allows him to. But if we let him work in our lives and make the changes he requests of us, he will grow our character and use us in greater ways. And so we can stifle the change in our lives. We can stifle the work of God in our lives by refusing to trust God and change as he's calling us to. Let's continue reading in Exodus 14, verse 15. And the Lord said unto Moses, "Wherefore criest thou unto me? Speak unto the children of Israel that they go forward. But lift thou up thy rod and stretch out thine hand over the sea and divide it, and the children of Israel shall go on dry ground through the midst of the sea. And I, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, and I will get me honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord when I have gotten my honor upon Pharaoh and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen." God wants us to bring our fears and doubts and feelings to him, but at some point, he wants us to stop wallowing in our feelings and choose to trust him. And it's challenging because you would think in this situation the ideal solution would be for the Egyptian army to turn around and leave. But God had a different plan. The Egyptian army was actually going to chase them into the Red Sea. That's not the sort of plan I would have come up with, but it is the plan God had. And that's because the end he had was so much greater than anything they had imagined possible, which was the wiping out of the greatest military on earth. And yet, it required of Moses, it required of the Israelites, that they would be willing to trust God and his direction. And it reminds me just a little bit of going to the lake as a young man. Paintsville Lake runs not so far from our house, it's about 20 miles long, and since it's in Kentucky, kind of got steep banks and hills and rocky cliffs, and the lake is below. And of course, being young boys, we thought it would be great to jump off some of the ledges. And we had one there close to where we typically camp that's about 30 feet high. And when you were down in the water looking up, it didn't look so bad. But when you were at the top and you began looking down, it looked terrifying. And yet everyone else would say, "Jump, jump, jump." And it's like, "Well, you jump first." But if you intended to jump, standing looking over the edge didn't really do you a whole lot of good. And think about how high it was not helpful either. And having everybody else go didn't necessarily make it any better. At some point, if you were going to jump, you just needed to start running toward that edge. And it's true in that sense with following God too. Because what we want to do is we want to sit back and wait till everything is figured out, till God has made it 100% clear what the end is going to be of all of our choices, and God doesn't work that way. It should be no surprise to us that God works at a scale that challenges our belief. God is bigger than we are. His kingdom spans generations and kingdoms. He is not a harsh or exacting God, but he asks us to trust him, to place our faith in him, to partner with him in doing his work. And it doesn't matter whether we understand the outcome or not. I often wonder what Job thought. What was the value of this? Do you think that his increased wealth was enough for him to say, "Well, I guess it was worth it"? Job, I can't think that Job ever knew the complete impact of his going through that experience and it being recorded for succeeding generations. God's plan for Job was much bigger than Job. He was impacting the rest of human history through the experience of Job. We don't think that way, but God does, and it's okay. And it's exciting if we're willing to let God work in our experience and use us as he sees best. And God is very faithful in rewarding steps of faith. He's very faithful in confirming us in following him. And we see something like that in Gideon, for instance, who was so fearful and indecisive, and he laid out a fleece one time, and then he changed it to another time, and there's no magical way of getting God's direction. God is just being very patient with Gideon and saying, okay, I will go with you, and I'll teach you. And finally, at the very end, after Gideon is done doing all of the things he thinks he needs to do to find out whether he really ought to do this or not, God has one more for him and says, if you're still afraid, go on down to the camp. I've got something for you to listen to down there. And we see God's graciousness in this account as well. Before they had to cross the Red Sea, God moves the cloud behind the nation of Israel, and he brings the light onto the nation of Israel, and there's a separation made between the Egyptians and the Israelites. Let's read here in verse 19. And the angel of God, which went before the camp of Israel, removed and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before their face and stood behind them. And it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. And it was a cloud and darkness to them, but it gave light by night to these, so that the one came not near to the other all night. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night and made the sea dry land, and the waters were divided. So Moses turned the people's attention to God and his trustworthiness, and Moses listened to God's direction, and we see the nation of Israel witnessing God's action, and God continues to lead them faithfully step by step by step. And one of the things that fascinated me that the teacher said as we were sitting there over dinner is she said that there was a point in which she knew that between her and God, they knew that every question or objection she had raised had been answered, but nobody else really knew. And she thought to herself, you know, I wouldn't have to do this because only God and I know. And then she thought, why am I thinking this way? God and I know. And here is the thing. When we step into what God wants us to do and he confirms for us very graciously, step after step, there's a point in which we know that if we don't keep moving in the direction God is calling us to, it is our choice to take our own way. And that leads us to the third positive response that we're talking about here that is very necessary that God calls us to, which the other responses have been leading us to, and that is the response of obedience. The result of focusing on God and growing in faith is always obedience. Moses did not say, God, I trust you, I love you, but I'm just going to sit here and see what happens. Instead, realizing God's faithfulness and ability to do what he had promised, we see Moses acting in obedience to God's command. Now, it's easy for us to get a bit confused as we think about this as to what obedience actually means. God was not telling the Israelites that they had to conquer the Egyptian army. He wasn't asking them to find a way across the Red Sea. He was simply asking them to do what he had asked them to do, the simple steps of obedient cooperation so that he could fulfill his plan for them. And I think that's similar in our own lives. God is not asking us to do impossible things. And when you look at a situation and it seems completely overwhelming and impossible, God's requirement for obedience is not that we completely resolve that situation or that need or that problem. He's simply asking us to take the next step in partnership with him so that he can work the way he would like to work through us and through others. Moses' only real responsibility here was to remind the Israelites of who God was and what he could do and to stretch out his rod over the sea. And the Israelites really only had one requirement, which was that they would trust God and step in faith into that path that he had created, which is exactly what we see happening here in verse 22. And the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea upon the dry ground, and the waters were a wall unto them on the right hand and on their left. Simple obedience, but difficult nonetheless. You could ask yourself, is taking a step hard? No. But is stepping on a seabed between two walls of suspended water difficult? Yes. Why? It all comes back to trust in God, doesn't it? But you have to take the next step, and we see that. As we recall from Isaiah 41, God said, in his promise, I will bring the blind by a way they knew not, And in chapter 30, and thine eyes shall hear a word behind thee saying, this is the way, walk ye in it, when ye turn to the right hand and when ye turn to the left. Simple obedience is not always easy. Isaiah said that, confirmed that in verse 20 of chapter 30, where he said, and though the Lord give you the bread of adversity and the water of affliction, yet shall not thy teachers be removed. But it is important. And I was inspired by the testimony of David Livingstone, where he said, forbid that we should ever consider the holding of a commission from the King of Kings a sacrifice, so long as other men esteem the service of an earthly government as an honor. I am a missionary, heart and soul. God himself had an only son, and he was a missionary and a physician. A poor, poor imitation I am, but in this service I hope to live. In it I wish to die. I still prefer poverty and mission service to riches and ease. This is my final choice. And that mindset of dedication to God and privilege in serving God and the trustworthiness of God will cause us to step out in obedience to God and do what he has asked us to. And we can see the heroes of faith did just that. If you read down over Hebrews 11, you'll see time after time after time, people who stepped out in obedience to what God asked them to do. And when we do so, we will see God's plan unfold. It will be more than we can imagine. It will be God at work in the world, and it will be marvelous. And this brings us to our final response to Red Sea experiences. And we looked at it this morning. Just want to touch on it again. And this is the response of praise. Because when we see God working, and we know that he's faithful, and our steps of faith are confirmed, we are called to praise. And you know this account because we just reviewed it, but the Israelites chose to believe. They chose to obey. They chose to follow Moses' direction, to focus on God and his trustworthiness. They chose to take that first step, and the next step, and the next step, and they made it across their families, their belongings, across a seabed of all things, between two walls of water. And they turned around and they watched the entire army of Egypt perish in the surging waters. It was beyond what they could have asked or what they could have thought or what they could have imagined. Without lifting a spear or shooting an arrow, they had prevailed. It was amazing. It was unbelievable. It was beyond anything they had expected, I think. But God had triumphed. And what is the response? I think for those who are focused on God, who are walking in obedient steps of faith, the response is inevitable. It follows. And that is the response of praise. And we read some of those verses. I'll just read a couple of them again here. Exodus 15, then sang Moses and the children of Israel this song unto the Lord, and spake, saying, I will sing unto the Lord, for he hath triumphed gloriously. The horse and his rider he has thrown into the sea. And why is the response a response of praise? The response is a response of praise because a work has been accomplished that we didn't do. Simply by following God in obedience, we were allowed to participate in the work of God in the world that was beyond our capacity to have any control or charge over. So the very thing we thought we needed or wanted would have been the very thing that kept us from relationship with God and cut us out of the opportunity of praise. But when we give in to God's call in our lives and we surrender to what he asks us to do and we take the simple steps of obedience, then we see God at work in ways beyond our ability to control, and we can praise him. And you don't see the children of Israel and Moses saying, wow, isn't it wonderful what we pulled off? They say, isn't it wonderful what God did? Because there's no way they could have pulled it off, but God let them participate in his work. Verse 2, the Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will prepare him an habitation. My father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name. Pharaoh's chariots and his hosts, as he cast into the sea, his chosen captains also are drowned in the Red Sea. The response of praise in our hearts and in our lives recognizes that God alone is the author and finisher of our faith. He is the one who both calls and enables to fulfill our calling. He is able to do abundantly above all that we ask or think. And as we respond in praise, our hearts are prepared to trust him more. It is a cycle that leads us into the next step. And we can continue to follow him in what he's asking us to do. Recall to mind the verses in 2 Samuel chapter 22, where he said, "The Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and exalted be the God of the rock of my salvation. It is God that avengeth me, and that bringeth down the people under me, and that bringeth me forth from my enemies. Thou also hast lifted me up on high above them that rose up against me. Thou hast delivered me from the violent man. Therefore I will give thanks unto thee, O Lord, among the heathen. I will sing praises unto thy name." And our praise becomes a testimony to those who don't know God, who are not trusting God, who do not believe in God, who are protecting their lives from God. Praise speaks. Praise speaks to them. Well, in closing, you find yourself standing at the crossroads of decision or facing challenge or adversity or need or something that seems bigger than you this morning. Are you looking over the ledge and asking, how big of a drop is that? Or maybe, perhaps somewhat worse, do you have your head buried in the sand, and have you stopped listening to God's leading, and have you hedged yourself up with walls all around so that life doesn't feel like it's asking anything of you beyond your ability? Or are we focusing on God? Are we believing in his promises? Are we changing our course to align with the course he's called us to? Are we living in obedience? And are we lifting him up in praise for his faithfulness? Now, Hebrews 10:38 says, "Now the just shall live by faith, but if any man draw back, my soul shall have no pleasure in him." But the psalmist writes in 118:46, "The Lord liveth, and blessed be my rock, and let the God of my salvation be exalted. It is God that avengeth me and subdueth the people under me. He delivereth me from mine enemies. Therefore will I give thanks unto thee, O Lord, and sing praises unto thy name." And that's our choice. That's the choice that lies before us, whether we will trust God, whether we will live in faith, whether we will step out with him, whether we will see his work and praise him for what he's doing, or whether we will draw back. And it's a challenge for each one of us. May God give us his direction and peace as we seek to serve him.